Binge Mode Star Wars is presented by State Farm.
State Farm agents know that sometimes life throws everything at you at once.
Like a fender bender when you're already late.
When it comes to auto and home insurance, State Farm agents are there for you.
Talk to one of the 19,000 State Farm agents via text, over phone, in person, or using the State Farm app.
Find one today at statefarm.com.
Today's show is also brought to you by Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order, the new action-adventure game from Respawn Entertainment.
Taking place between Star Wars Revenge of the Sith and Star Wars A New Hope, players will wield a lightsaber, hone their force powers, and adventure across the galaxy in hopes of rebuilding the Jedi Order.
Become a Jedi in Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order.
Available now on Xbox One, PS4, and PC.
Rated T for Teen.
Let's go out with something really hot for these folks. A big hit out of 77.
Oh, Star Wars, nothing but Star Wars. Give me those Star Wars. Don't let them end. Yeah. Oh, spoilers. Yes, there are spoilers and adult content. Yeah, because it's binge mode.
Welcome to Binge Mode Star Wars, proudly a part of the Ringer Podcast Network.
What a great network.
Indeed. I'm Mallory Rubin, editor-in-chief of
TheRinger.com. Oh, what a great website.
It's great. Joining me today, now that he's finished whipping up a new tune for his cantina set, that's right. Ringer Senior Creative, your Jedi Master, your conductor, if you will, Jason Concepcion.
Mal, I've got a great feeling about this. And what an amazing new smell you've discovered. It's Binge Mode Star Wars, where we're exploring the wider Star Wars universe from the Skywalker saga films to the anthology films to The Mandalorian, plus numerous other facets of a galaxy far, far away, all leading up to the release of Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker on December 20th. Please, make the journey to Chalmers with us. It's just a great place where everybody knows your name. By subscribing to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate and review us. Give us the 5-star ratings, or Figrandon and the modal nodes will never tickle your eardrums.
Never.
With their beautiful, dulcet tones again. Please also follow us on Twitter and Instagram at binge_mode, aka the underscore, and join our Facebook group, which is just for Binge Mode fans, and which is an excellent place to debate the merits of quank jazz. And please head to theringer.com/shop to check out our Binge Mode merch. Ideal. Spending an evening at Sully's listening to Jats.
Last time on Binge Mode, we explored chapter 1 of The Mandalorian, which we loved. And today, we're diving deep.
Deep into
the sounds of Star Wars, from John Williams' iconic score to the sound design behind your favorite Wookiee. As always, spoiler warning. We will be going deep on details from the entire Star Wars saga to date, taking official canon and legends, hashtag not canon, into account. So let's head to Jabba's Palace, because it's time to catch the latest set from the Max Rebo Band. Jason?
Yes.
Your eyes can deceive you. That's Don't right. trust them. But your ears?
Oh, important.
Let those lead you.
That's right.
And that gets us to this episode's big idea. So let's search our feelings and use the force. The defining theme of this episode is the legacy of John Williams' Star Wars score.
Oh, it's huge.
Let's start By learning more about the Chosen One of galactic scoring, the man responsible for Star Wars' music, and thus one of the people who most informs the very essence of what
yes.
Star Wars is. So much of the soul, so much of the wonder, so much of the instantly recognizable and forever ingrained majesty of the sounds of space. John Williams.
What is there to say about John Williams that hasn't already been said?
I hope something.
We're going to try. Here are some of the many memorable movies and immediately recognizable scores that he has added to films that you are surely familiar with. How about Star Wars, right? Which we're going to talk
about. I'm familiar.
What about Jaws?
Uh-huh.
What about Superman?
Indeed.
What about Indiana Jones?
Ooh.
E.T., Schindler's List, Jurassic Park, Saving Private Ryan, Harry Potter.
Ever heard of it?
Ever fucking heard of it.
Oh, Zach Cram listens to the Harry score while he writes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, there's a little fun Zach Cram nugget for you, folks.
Really fun. I love it. Great use of the Lydian mode. The man is so famous, so accomplished, that the awards section of his Wikipedia page is split into six subsections.
That's unbelievable.
And even that doesn't encapsulate the entirety of his career. He's won 5 Oscars.
Unbelievable.
Been nominated, only 51 times.
Take that, Meryl.
This is ridiculous. Second most in history behind Walt Disney.
Wow.
He's been nominated in 6 consecutive decades.
That is incredible.
And won so many other awards that it's impossible to list them all here without taking up the entire runtime of this podcast, which actually we might do it.
Williams was born in New York, just like Jason.
That's right.
In 1932, not just like Jason.
That's right.
But he moved to LA just like Jason. That's right. As a teen, and he eventually attended UCLA, go Bruins, studied with Italian teacher
Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco.
Wonderful. Who was himself a renowned Hollywood composer. And after stints in the Air Force Band and at Juilliard, Williams moved back to California, where he began his career as a session musician and a composer for television. According to his personal website, Williams wrote music for hundreds of episodes of shows like A Call-Up Premiere, Kraft Suspense Theater, Chrysler Theater, and Playhouse 90.
Fucking crushing it. But, of course, it was his film career that made John Williams the most famous composer in the country, perhaps the world. The first feature film he worked on was 1958's Daddy-O.
Love it.
A forgettable flick. About drag racing beatniks. I mean, it aged well. About drag racing beatniks with the tagline, alive with the beat and the heat of today's rock and roll generation.
I'm going to be honest. That sounds great.
Daddy-O is remembered for 2 reasons. Being mocked on an episode of Mystery Science Theater 1000 and serving as Williams' feature debut.
Wonderful. Throughout the 1960s and early 70s, Williams worked on a variety of projects, more feature films, also TV movies, TV shows, and score adaptations of previous work. And it was through that latter category that he received his first Oscar nomination for Valley of the Dolls and his first win for Best Scoring Adaptation and Original Song Score as he helped bring Zach Cram's cherished Fiddler on the Roof.
I mean, what hasn't this man touched?
From the stage to the big screen.
It's honestly crazy.
He's an icon, a titan.
It really is. And then his career really took off.
Yeah, that was all before his career took off.
Yeah, just like Fiddler on the Roof. And hundreds of episodes of television. Oh. Then his career really took off. Because he began working with a young, ambitious director named Steven Spielberg. Ever heard of him? Who tasked Williams with scoring his little movie about a killer shark named Jaws.
Mm.
Partnership produced another Oscar-winning soundtrack. Then, playing matchmaker, Spielberg suggested John Williams to his good buddy George Lucas.
They can't only talk about battle droids.
That's it.
You know?
He's like,
sounds
hey,
great. That sounds great.
You need a soundtrack, right?
They got to talk about
I
other
got a guy.
Too.
And wonder of wonder, miracle of miracles, that film and Williams' score were hits. Mega hits.
Huge.
Do you love me? They asked audiences across the country, and audiences responded with a resounding yes. The Star Wars soundtrack won Williams another Oscar, went platinum when it was released as its standalone album. A disco version of the main theme and cantina song created by producer Mecco reached number one on the Billboard charts.
That is honestly astonishing. That's amazing.
That's the interesting thing about this soundtrack. It really was a curveball for the time. Disco was the reigning genre. And so doing a kind of throwback orchestral score was seen at the time as certainly for a project that was as off the beaten trail as Star Wars, was seen as a risk. Mm-hmm. So it gave them another move in that they could then release the disco version and rake in the dollars.
Amazing. In a 1999 NBC News interview around the release of Phantom Menace, Lucas said of working with Williams, quote, "The first film, I was very nervous. I worked a little bit more closely with him. And then after that, I just let him do whatever he does.
It's honestly a great, great show. I think John Williams has it. Just let him do it.
Let him roll."
It soon became tradition for Williams to work on each core Star Wars project, even through the sunrise, sunset of the prequel trilogy, which Williams salvaged in part with the likes of Duel of Fates, great one, and Across the Stars, and after Lucas pondered if he could be a rich man and sold Lucasfilm to Disney. By the current decade, Star Wars universe was perhaps far from the home Lucas loved, but Williams stayed on even without his longtime collaborator. By December, when Episode 9's The Rise of Skywalker arrives, Williams will have completed the scores on all 9 films in the Skywalker saga.
Congratulations on incorporating all of those Fiddler on the Roof references into that description. So what about John Williams' style? How does Williams craft his signature sounds? How does he write arrangements that are at once the inspiration for homages and copycats everywhere and that are unmistakably his, specifically his, that make us hear Star Wars as keenly as we see it and feel it?
Williams is known for using themes, specifically the musical term leitmotif, a Wagnerian technique. Wagner, by the way, bad guy, but great composer, that utilizes a recurring musical motif that corresponds with the core character, a significant location or thematic concept. He uses them so much that if you Google the word leitmotif, the first related image is one of the Imperial March from Star Wars. When used well, as Williams does, a leitmotif can serve as a powerful connective tissue, adding unifying layers underneath the surface-level sentiment of the moment.
For example, old Ben Kenobi's theme.
Could that be Obi-Wan Kenobi?
I wonder if he means old Ben Kenobi's theme, a.k.a. the Force theme, which is first introduced in its entirety during the absolutely iconic binary sunset scene in A New Hope, Luke gazing out into the distance, staring longingly at the sky while the two suns of Tatooine begin to set upon the horizon. And it's reprised repeatedly throughout the saga, but most notably in the final moments of Luke's life toward the end of The Last Jedi, when, just like his younger self, Luke is staring at the setting sun, this time before joining the cosmic force. Now, the tenderness of that cue alone is a highly effective compliment for the scene, but the significance is enhanced by the motif powerfully bookending Luke's arc.
Williams is known for an affinity for brass instruments. I think when I think of brass in soundtracks, I think of Bernard Herrmann, who scored many of Hitchcock's films and Taxi Driver as well. Brass is muscular and just powerful, often ominous, especially when used with sparing amounts of strings. Like many film score composers of the time, he's influenced by late 19th century and early 20th century neo-romanticism, traces of composers such as Tchaikovsky, Mahler, Wagner, and even some Stravinsky. When Williams does lean into more string-heavy arrangements, like Ray's theme, which Isaac called a New World Symphony remix, it's often reminiscent of Isaac's favorite composer of all time, Dvorak.
So how did Williams find his Star Wars sound specifically? Well, in a behind-the-scenes documentary about the making of the Empire Strikes Back score, producer Gary Kurtz offered this insight into Williams' first step into a larger Star Wars world. Quote, "Originally, John was recommended to George Lucas by Steven Spielberg, who had used him on Jaws."
Dun, dun. Dun, dun. Dun, 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 dun,
dun. We had all liked the Jaws score very much.
Yeah, it's good.
It was a traditional symphonic score. We went through a period in feature films where traditional scores were not used. This is, of course, similar to the point Jason was making earlier. The quote continues, popular music scores and jazz scores were the rage in the 60s into the early 70s. We felt for Star Wars that it was very important that it be a traditional romantic score.
That decision, very fair to say, forever changed the history, accessibility, and visibility of cinematic scoring.
Yes.
In that same documentary, Williams said, quote, my first concern is a rhythmic one. I sense a speed to film. Every scene seems to have an underlying tempo or a series of tempi, a whole set of them, perhaps, at different levels. The dialogue may go at a certain speed, the action may go at another speed. So the thing that I try to feel and spot in the early stages of a film are simple things like how fast is it or how slow is it? When is the point in the film's life that it accelerates? When does it press on, press forward? When are the brakes put on? In my mind, that's the first consideration.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Fascinating. Around the turn of the millennium, the American Film Institute, AFI, celebrated 100 years of American cinema by making a ton of best of lists. You can find all of them online. Star Wars, A New Hope, ranked number one for best score. And for many people, it remains the absolute pinnacle, the titanic achievement against which all other efforts are measured.
Performances for the first two trilogies came from the London Symphony Orchestra. Ever heard of it? For the new trilogy, the Hollywood Freelance Studio Symphony. And the physical location wasn't all that evolved. Before Force Awakens, Williams said in an interview with the Star Wars YouTube channel, quote, I haven't seen the script. The story is still unknown to me. But I can't imagine that there will not be some references to the existing stories that we know that would necessitate and make appropriate the use of some of the earlier themes, which actually for me has been part of the fun of doing film after film, because in each case, I've been able to use the earlier material and develop new material that would coexist with it.
And that statement obviously helps to solidify something that is in some ways intuitive for us. Williams is always innovating, always experimenting, always trying to create and craft something new, but he's doing that in concert with an effort to continually connect to the past, building these ties just as he's building something new so that you always feel like you're heading into this fresh frontier while also just bathing and basking in those familiar sounds and cues.
In a 2005 NPR interview, Williams explained that because the themes of the movie went beyond sci-fi tropes, he went that way with his composition too. Quote, the translation of heroic impulses and feelings and reactions and thinking in terms of melodrama and opera brings us in the direction of a symphony orchestra rather than with a group of synthesizers or computers that might produce the spacey, otherworldly sounds you might expect. I think that's important.
I love that snippet, the quote, translation of heroic impulses idea so much. I mean, that's so core to how we think about these stories and how we talk about them. And it's truly a wonderful gift to get to hear him say that and get to think about how that informs his process. Because when you're thinking about a story like this and how you respond to it, well, what aspect of the hero's journey in general or Luke's journey or any other characters in particular do you respond to? Yeah. Why does it resonate with you in the way that it does? And sometimes it can be like a great joy in your life to get to articulate that answer, as we have the pleasure of doing here. Sometimes it can feel really hard to be able to put that framing around it in a way that allows you to say it out loud and articulate it with precision. And the thing about this is the music does that for you.
That's great.
It conveys for you that feeling in your heart and that thought in your mind.
You know, when I was learning about film scoring in college, one of the things, first things they tell you is there's this balance. It's like, when you notice the film score, that's probably bad. It needs to kind of melt into the scene in a way that supports it. And I think John Williams pushes that envelope in a really interesting way, because, of course, you're blown away by the visuals on the screen, but the music is really front and center in a way that's kind of uncommon in a lot of other scores. I think Jaws is like that too, where you almost can't separate the suspense generated by the fin and the feeling that the shark is coming from that bum, 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 bum string motif. He's really in a category by himself in that way. William Taylor's, his approach for each track to what specifically the scene it pairs with is attempting to evoke. What's playing out on the screen? How will that make us feel? How can the music amplify that or even guide it?
One emblematic example would be Duel of the Fates. In that same 1999 NBC news feature on the making of the score, Williams spoke about crafting that specific tune. He said, quote, in thinking about what to put for this sword fight, Darth Maul.
Sword fight.
Sword fight. Incredible. This arch villain and his fantastic balletic exploits with these swords swords. It's so funny. I thought the music could have a religiosity to it.
I love it.
So you felt you were watching a ritual. That is incredible. Quote continues, chorus and orchestra always give you a feeling like you're in church or you're participating in a spectacle. And that's what I hoped the music would give this sword fight, so that it wasn't action music accompanying fighting, but some support to a spiritual contest. And that, I mean, that really like allows us to think about so many of the things that we've been talking about. The point that you were just making about how the score has to be totally of a piece and at one with the rest of the film, but also is such an achievement that you can't help but notice it. You can't help but think about it, how it is informed by what is on the screen, but also then informs what is on the screen. That just incredible symbiosis that really is uncommonly rare, singular.
Williams was ultimately nominated for an Oscar for 5 of the 8 main movie soundtracks, each movie in the original trilogy and the new trilogy, but not any of the prequels. The soundtracks for A New Hope and The Phantom Menace went platinum. Empires and Attack of the Clones soundtracks reached gold.
One more tough beat for the prequels there. Let's talk about the legacy and influence on the rest of not only Star Wars, but
he's a giant.
Culture at large. Williams is present in the sounds of Star Wars, even when he's not the one crafting the score. Michael Giacchino scored Rogue One, and in so doing, he incorporated many of Williams' themes as he adapted the familiar music, like the Imperial March, to a new kind of story. In an interview on StarWars.com, he said that he wanted to include, quote, little Easter eggs that you would get to and go, oh, yeah. It's a way of reminding you of the universe you're in as well. I certainly didn't want to say, hey, I'm going to do a whole new thing with this, and now it's going to sound like heavy metal. I wanted it to feel like home. I wanted people watching it to feel like they were in a Star Wars universe. That quote, I wanted it to feel like home, is so wonderful.
It is wonderful. The composers behind Solo and the Clone Wars and Rebels and Resistance animated series all included these kind of homages to Williams's work. For Solo, Williams wrote a half a dozen small pieces for the film, according to StarWars.com, which helped set the tone for composer John Powell's work. Quote, once John had written his stuff, it all made a lot more sense, and I really felt like we'd figured out the puzzle, he said. I also took the themes and I developed them in different ways for other sections that he hadn't scored. They're woven in and out of the fabric of the whole score. During the Kessel Run sequence, Powell specifically referenced the music that played during the escape through the asteroid field in Empire because of the Han parallels. And in a sci-fi.com interview in 2018, Kevin Kiner, the composer behind the Clone Wars series, said Dave Filoni told him, quote, George doesn't really want us to use too many of John Williams' Star Wars themes on this show at first. He wants it to kind of have its own voice. So Kiner said, they'd sometimes go entire episodes at a time without so much as referencing Williams' work. With Rebels, though, given the time period and subject matter, the score was much more connected to the movie tracks. Quote, we quoted the heck out of that, Kiner said, of the New Hope score in particular. Hilarious flex from Kiner in that interview as he talks about composing for so many TV episodes. Quote, if you're measuring by the pound, I win. I've written more Star Wars music than anyone else alive, and I might hold that record for a pretty long time. I think here's a very simple way to kind of measure the influence and legacy of John Williams. Name 5 film composers not named John Williams.
Isaac, Jason asked you a question.
Oh.
Alexander
but honestly, like, ask anyone, Gorenson. Like, across, yes. It doesn't even matter if you know music. Just in the popular imagination.
Yeah. He's mainstream. Across properties. Williams' tracks have become so ingrained in our brains and our cultures that we instantly recognize them. To Jason's point, we recognize his name, but you hear one note of one of his scores and you know what it is and who it's from. The Imperial March, in particular, has become synonymous with authoritarianism and evil. You hear a second of that, you know immediately the kind of tone that whoever's playing it is attempting to set. Fun story from Cram. In high school, he says he had a teacher who would play the Imperial March every time an administrator came to their class to tell them about signing up for electives or graduation requirements. That's strange, but intriguing. Everyone, though, has that one sound from Star Wars that triggers some sort of almost Pavlovian response in them. Think of the way that you felt when you first saw the Phantom Menace trailer. Or years later, decades later, the Force Awakens trailer, the way that hearing the signature tones made you know just as fully as seeing the Millennium Falcon flash across the screen or a lightsaber whoosh across your screen that you were back in the Star Wars universe, back in that galaxy. Think of how people don't want to be away from these sounds really longer than they have to at all. Think of how many people, for example, have Star Wars ringtones. People want to carry these sounds with them.
You know, who has Star Wars ringtones is Ben Burtt, the pioneering sound designer who we will talk about in the Jedi Temple. He uses some of unused sounds from, I believe it's The Force Awakens, as his ringtone.
Wonderful.
Incredible.
What a flex.
Sometimes we hear these tunes blaring into a far bigger audience than just those in earshot of our phones. Mm. Think of Star Wars and sports. Number of Star Wars themes have been used by sports teams. EPL club Tottenham with Duel of the Fates during its lineup introductions. Many NBA teams use the Imperial March when introducing the opposing team, which I don't get because it's like it makes the opposing team seem too scary.
More menacing.
Yeah, like you should play like the Benny Hill theme or something really pratfally. Like,
like
play
Jar Jar. Yeah. Give us some Gungan sounds.
Yeah, play something bad while you play something good. Meanwhile, the Yankees introduce their own lineups, the tune of Throne Room and End Title, the medal ceremony song from the end of The New Hope. While introducing their opponent's lineups to the tune of the Imperial March, here again.
Yes, same thing.
What are we doing? Also, you guys are the evil empire. Why are you doing this? And Brian Cashman himself has called the Yankees a Death Star. They should be the ones embracing the Imperial March. What are you doing?
And you would know. You are a...
I love the Yankees.
Famous.
Been a fan.
Passionate Yankee
of
fan.
The pinstripes. Is that how they say it?
Yeah. No, CeCe's dealing nails.
Dealing them.
And of course... Star Wars score has influenced countless other musicians and composers. In a 2016 New Yorker piece titled Listening to Star Wars, which is great and really worth a read, longtime New Yorker music critic Alex Ross details delightfully how many current composers have been influenced in this way. London Symphony Orchestra members in particular, he highlights as being inspired to musical careers by listening to Star Wars as kids. One of the people who Ross interviewed for this piece was conductor David Robertson. And this Robertson quote that Ross used in this article really wonderfully sums up and gets at Williams's influence on his fellows. Quote, "He's a man singularly fluent in the language of music," Robertson told Ross. "That. He's very unassuming, very humble. But when he talks about music, he can be the most interesting professor you've ever heard. He's a deep listener. And that explains his ability to respond to film so acutely." What a wonderful way to frame how influential and inspiring he is for fellow musicians, but not just fellow musicians, for all of us. But you're both a fan of Star Wars and a musician yourself. So for you, what's the lasting legacy and impact?
John Williams is just a master at once serving a scene, which is important because music is utilitarian in a sense. It has to help tell the story, but it can't be the subject of what's being told. And at the same time, creating something that's so unforgettable that you want to hear it again and again because it not only is wonderful in its own right, melodically, rhythmically, fascinating, intriguing to listen to, pleasing to the ear, but it can't help but evoke those feelings once again when you hear it. I'm a fan of film composing in general. Like, you know, The Last of the Mohicans is one of my favorites. I love the Glory soundtrack. Michael Horn is great, RIP. Trevor Jones of The Last of the Mohicans. I don't love all that soundtrack, but there are certain Promontory is probably the great one. I think they used it for an NFL commercial semi-recently. I love Trent Reznor's work on The Social Network. It's really cool.
Although that's incredible.
With Atticus
incredible
Ross,
score.
Although that's a lot more focused and kind of genre-based in a lot of ways, like that electronic kind of pulse, which you couldn't really use for everything. But there's something so traditional and wonderful about what John Williams does. His ability to kind of cut to the core of a character in a scene with just a few themes and melodic ideas to create something that's like really eternal is amazing. And beyond that, he has become such a great exemplar of what you can do with music. You know, like film scoring is, you know, a job that is really thankless in the sense that other than John Williams, as we noted, you don't really know who these people are. Bernard Herrmann gets some play, I guess, because he did all the Hitchcock stuff, but you don't really know the names of these people. But John Williams made it cool to be like, oh man, what was that? Like, that'd be cool, wouldn't it? To help tell these stories. I just think he's just an incredible legend. When you go down his resume, it's honestly astonishing.
Yeah, it defies belief.
Astonishing that one person could have touched all these different properties. It's like, what?
It's remarkable, truly. That's all awesome to hear. And you, obviously, you and Isaac have a level of musical expertise and knowledge that, you know, I personally do not have. And I'm sure for all of our listeners and all the people who watch Star Wars, people relate to the music just that, like they relate to all the different aspects of the story differently in a way that is specific to them. What about your own life allows you to connect to something in a certain way? But I think what is, well, one of the many things that is so remarkable about what John Williams has done, about the Star Wars score that he has crafted, is that it's there for you to appreciate in whatever way you want. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I think you and I both love so much about so many of these stories. And the music is a part of that in this sense. You know, the way that this quote is used is not necessarily applicable here, but I think the language of it is. There's this moment in the final season of Halt and Catch Fire, a show that I love, where Lee Pace, a man that I love,
it's loved by many,
says, in a circumstance that I won't spoil for people, he says, quote, it was never about where it ended up. It was always about how it felt. And since the moment that I heard that, it's been one of my favorite quotes. And I think about it often when something just makes its way into my heart and sticks with me in some way. And, you know, it's true for so many of the things in your life that you connect with. Like we've been talking a lot about his Dark Materials as we're making our way through the story again. And I have this experience with it where, when I first read those books, I loved them so fully. And when I sat down with them heading into the debut of the show to revisit them, I realized that I had forgotten an incredible amount of the specific plot details, but it had no bearing on my love for it because the thing that I remembered was how it made me feel, right? And that's just one of countless examples that I could give. And so when I hear John Williams' score, I know how it makes me feel, whether or not I know anything about the technical aspect of crafting it is irrelevant to me. And that's just real magic that he put into the world.
I think about John Williams like this. This music is actually inextricable from the experience of watching these movies now. And that's, you cannot say that. Think about whatever the last movie you saw is. Take away the score, replace it with some other kind of just as high quality music score. Do you notice? Do you care? Probably not, honestly. Right.
If you did it with Star Wars, it would seem like a bastardization of something sacred.
Is this? Yeah. A great example of like how John Williams is able to support and also play kind of like a inextricable role in the storytelling of a movie is Close Encounters. Mm-hmm. I think about the scene towards the end where the humans have invited the aliens down and they're trying to communicate with them and they're using that musical theme that bum 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 bum, and that turns into this blast of like sound and light. That's like John Williams stepping forward and being like, okay, I'm going to design this thing that allows humans to interact with aliens. That's absolutely core to the storytelling mechanics of this movie, and you couldn't do without him. And that's various interviews he has noted that as one of the favorite films that he's done with Spielberg. He's a giant.
It unlocks something fundamental about how you understand the story that you're consuming, but also maybe more importantly than how you understand it, how you respond to it emotionally and spiritually.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Return we will after word from our sponsors.
Binge Mode Star Wars. It's presented by State Farm.
State Farm agents know that sometimes life throws everything at you at once.
Like a fender bender when you're already late.
When it comes to auto and home insurance, State Farm agents are there for you.
Talk to one of 19,000 State Farm agents via text, over the phone, in person, or using the State Farm app.
Find one today at statefarm.com.
And now back to binge mode. All right, Jason.
Yes.
Never tell me the odds, but please Tell me about the whooshes and whirps.
Oh, yes.
Tell me about the beeps and boops.
I love it.
That have become inextricable from the Star Wars experience. We have highlighted the score, and we will do so again momentarily with a special guest. The special guest is Isaac Lee, spoiler alert. But Star Wars is about balance. So help us understand the other facet of the auditory experience in a galaxy far, far away. Please gather to Padawan learners, head to the Jedi Temple. Teach us everything we need to know about the sound design of Star Wars.
Yes. A microphone with a damaged cable reacting to the hum from a tube television, jet engines, wind ripping over a mountaintop, bears, lions, walruses. These are just some of the earthly sounds used to create the otherworldly sounds found in Star Wars. Quote, "The sound effects in Star Wars are really what gives these fantastic visuals credibility." Pioneering sound designer Ben Burtt says this in a documentary about the making of Attack of the Clones. Burtt worked on the original trilogy, the prequels, The Force Awakens, as well as many other films, including Munich, the Star Trek reboots, the Indiana Jones movies, and many more, winning 4 Academy Awards, including one for special achievements for sound effects editing in Star Wars.
Munich, man.
Much of what I'm going to discuss comes of a wonderful documentary titled Star Wars Episode 4 Sound Design, explained by Ben Burtt.
Incredible.
Released on YouTube in April 2019. So let's talk about some of the iconic sounds of Star Wars. How about Chewbacca?
I can't do it. Help me. Teach me how to do it.
Burtt began his career with an uncredited stint doing sound on B-movie legend Roger Corman's 1975 movie Death Race 2000. His next feature film project was Star Wars. Pretty good come up. And his first job after getting the gig was to create the sound of Chewbacca. Quote, "They wanted to have samples of what Chewbacca might sound like prior to shooting because it would be an aid in the actual directing of the film and it would help the actor Peter Mayhew," Burtt said. He layered recordings of various bears to craft Chewie's vocalizations. Quote, "The sound a bear makes is kind of from the back of the throat. There's no articulation of the lips to form consonants."
Huh.
"It went along well with Chewie's mask," he said in 2019. He then edited these down into shorter clips, which he organized according to the feelings he felt that they evoked. Questioning, angry, happy, and so on. These short clips were then strung together as sentences, if you like, to create Chewie's dialogue. Lightsabers.
Hell yeah.
Burtt worked as a projectionist for a time, and when he saw lightsabers in the pre-production concept art, he immediately thought of The Hum, produced by film projectors.
Hmm.
Still, that hum has a kind of like pleasing softness. Laser swords, right, were deadly and dangerous. Bit more edge was needed. Burtt found that edge serendipitously. He's walking across his apartment, carrying a tape recorder and a mic, as one does when one is a sound designer. The mic had a broken cable, and these items produced a buzz as he neared his television, a result of the interference between the electrical fields of these devices. Burtt combined this with the projector hum, and voila, the basis of a lightsaber. Now, to create the oral illusion of a lightsaber moving and slicing and arcing through the air, Burtt played a loop of the sound through a speaker, and he then stood in front of that speaker and re-recorded the sound using a handheld mic, which he waved around in front of the speaker in sync with the on-screen action.
That's
really cool to watch him. There's video.
Amazing.
You can watch him do this on YouTube.
That might be my single favorite sound in Star Wars, that specifically. It's just fucking amazing.
Now, there are several elements involved in the sound of lightsaber blades striking each other and other objects, but the crucial ingredient is carbon arc lamps. Arc lighting, invented in the early 19th century, was the first usable form of electric lighting technology. Carbon arc lamps, which were commonly used in the kind of lighting found on film and TV sets, used 2 carbon rods as the lighting elements. To ignite the lamp, the rods are touched together, then separated by a small distance, and voltage flows across the connected rods and then continues as the rods are drawn apart across the gap often accompanied by sparking. The sound it creates is crunchy, squeaky, and electrical, and perfect for the sound of the Jedi's signature weapon in battle. And all this came together in only 3 or 4 days. The TIE Fighter. This is a really wild one. Amazing. The distinctive howl of the Empire's frontline fighter craft was based on elephant sounds.
Wow.
From the 1958 20th Century Fox film Roots of Heaven, directed by John Huston, starring Trevor Howard and Errol Flynn as militant elephant protectors.
Wow.
Because Star Wars was a 20th Century Fox film, Burt had access to the sound library of basically anything he wanted to use from the 20th Century Fox film library. Oh, blasters. A mishap on a hike in Pennsylvania when Burt's backpack caught on a suspension cable anchoring a radio tower led to Burt's discovering the perfect blaster sound.
That's unbelievable.
When he returned to Southern California, he began searching for the right antenna or tower with the right set of wiring, and he found it near Palmdale, a particular radio tower with a particular high-tension wire which lacked the usual wind dampeners, these kind of like styrofoam balls which were used to stabilize the structure in high winds. It didn't have those. Now, when struck with a metallic object like a wrench, the wire produced a kind of zapping sound that sounded exactly what you'd expect a laser gun to sound like. This one wire became the basis for all the blasters that Burt sound designed throughout Star Wars.
Unbelievable.
R2-D2. The voice of R2-D2 turned out to be the most prolonged and difficult sound to develop, Burt said. That was about a year of work.
Holy shit. Incredible.
Why was it so hard? The difficulty was that R2, who everyone, by the way, initially
hated.
Absolutely. Burt was like, why do I have to do this? I hate this.
They heard R2 sounds. They hated it. They heard that Burt spent a year on it. They hated that. They thought it seemed inefficient.
They hated it. The difficulty was that R2 was a main character who had to communicate and emote without speaking and who has, additionally, only a limited palette of physicality and no ability to gesture as we understand it, right? C-3PO and Chewie were, by contrast, also main characters, of course. Easy to figure out. The former spoke English, and the latter's character design naturally suggested what it might sound like. With R2, there was no template. R2 is described early in the script for A New Hope as making, quote, a series of electronic sounds that only another robot can understand. Quite a broad description.
Learn binary, bro.
Finding the right mix of whistles, beeps, and buzzes required a lot of experimentation. George Lucas provided some important direction when he suggested that recording the vocalizations of infants could be useful. But the process was arduous, and Burt had a lot of trouble finding something that pleased Lucas. Eventually, Burt got what he needed by using his own voice, making the needed whistles and beeps and what have you, combined with the sounds created by an ARP synthesizer, an early analog synthesizer. Much in the same way that audio engineers, podcast engineers in particular, think about or consider room tone when recording in different locations, Burt re-recorded R2 sounds in various spaces, indoors and outdoors, to create a lived-in, spoken feel that sounded of a piece with the rest of the soundscape and dialogue. Darth Vader. Burt initially had Darth Vader sounding, quote, like an ER, with the beeping associated with an EKG machine, along with various other sounds, including clicks and wheezes meant to communicate the utility of Vader's life-supporting armor.
Clicking and wheezes, that sounds like me every day.
Turning Darth into an ominous ice cream truck, however, as you can imagine, was just a little too much.
Yeah, this is a good adjustment.
Yeah. But the basic idea of having an oral clue that lets the audience know that Darth is present, thus raising the tension, was obviously correct.
Yes, brilliant.
The carnival of beeps and clicks was paired back to just the breathing. The sound is a slowed-down playback of recordings of Burt breathing through various scuba tank regulators.
Wow.
Really cool. The breathing was layered with James Earl Jones's voice performance, and the combined track, as with R2-D2, was then played back in various rooms and re-recorded in this way. Darth's voice and breathing interacted with and was colored by these environments, created what's known as diegetic sounds. The audience experienced diegetic sounds, meaning sounds that feel like they're coming from within the scene.
Mm-hmm.
This is a technique that Burt has used throughout his career. Quote, "You don't want to build something in the studio that's clean and close up to the mic and just perfect. You want to make it seem like it was done on the set." One more fun fact about Vader, the sound of Darth from early in episode 4 strangling that rebel was created by placing walnut shells in the rind of a grapefruit and squeezing that.
Oh my God, it's like Rickon Stark out on the run, just crushing his walnuts, leaving a trail those poor farmer boys. Rickon?
What about the later films? How about The Last Jedi? Matthew Wood was the supervising sound director on The Last Jedi, and his team is responsible for sounds like Force Time Sessions, Porgs, and more. Ben Burtt, much to his confusion, by the way, was not asked to join this production.
What's up with that?
He doesn't know. You could read a Vanity Fair article about it where he's like, I don't know. BB-8. Ben Schwartz and Bill Hader, of course, provided the vocal material that was then fed through a synthesizer and would become BB-8's voice in The Force Awakens. For The Last Jedi, the sound of BB-8 rolling around in the casino sequence was created by placing small metal objects inside a metal sphere and kind of moving that around.
I love BB.
What about Time? The connection between Rey and Kylo is, of course, vital to The Last Jedi.
Yes.
That came about first and foremost from wanting a sense of intimacy, director Rian Johnson says in an ABC News documentary about the film's sound production. Quote, but we didn't want it to be about the effect. That's important. Inspired by the idea of a vacuum, of an absence of sound, the design team quite simply dramatically lowered the environmental tracks, leaving Rey and Ren alone together, exposed.
Incredible.
How about Porgs? This is
hell
fun.
Yeah.
The sound for the cutest creatures in The Last Jedi.
Precious.
Came together very quickly. The team layered sped up samples of chickens.
Oh no, don't tell Chewie that.
Delicious. As well as human voices making bird-like sounds inspired by turkey calls to craft the Porg vocalizations. Fun.
Oh, man.
Stuff in creating the Star Wars sounds.
That was incredible.
Yeah. Mal, stay on target. Stay on target. Lose it up! We have a lot to get to today, so let's roll like BB-8 through 8 of the most essential Star Wars themes, the cornerstones on which Star Wars scores are built.
Yes.
Lightning round style. And today, we have a special guest, Isaac Isley.
Ice!
Hey.
Bring us through it.
Tell us all about the most essential themes, man.
All right. We have to start with number one. Luke's theme, aka Star Wars theme, aka the main theme.
Play it for us.
Oh, man. Obviously, iconic, rousing overture that we're all familiar with that plays behind the opening crawl of every single Star Wars Skywalker saga film. It begins with that electrifying brass polyphony that retards down into a unison triplet on the dominant. I'm using music theory terms here, by the way.
T-A-R!
launching up a perfect fourth into the tonic and into that familiar melody that everyone has at least shouted along to in private or maybe in public. Fun fact, in my high school music theory class, this cadence here from the dominant, which is the five note up to the one note, that's how I was taught to recognize that interval, the perfect fourth interval. And harmonically, that's extremely satisfying because that's called the perfect authentic cadence. I won't get into that, but…
Well, I mean, I think it's important to talk about what it creates.
Yeah.
That kind of 1-4, 1-5… With the third thrown in, what you're getting is the sense of very grounded, very strong, very clear music. The chord and the scale is being clearly laid out for you in a way that conveys strength and absolutely no ambiguity about what the scale and the chord is.
Yeah. Music theorists will call that like returning home.
Yes.
If the tonic is the home, the dominant is like the launching pad that goes back to home. The melody for the second part of this theme that I didn't play is carried by a string section, which is very a little less dynamic, but still jubilant. And it crescendos back into that brass heavy part. And that's so satisfying too, to hear like, oh, this is kind of soothing string section. Right. And then back into this bum, 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 bum. Love it. Love it so much.
When we use the word iconic, which we use often here on Binge Mode and here at The Ringer, this is what we mean.
Yeah, it's iconic.
This is iconic. It's the iconic. Second you hear it, you know what it is. You remember what it felt like to hear it for the first time. It is instantly recognizable as being a one-of-a-kind thing that also has spawned and inspired an entire constellation of sound around it. And it gets you fucking hyped. That's my musical theory analysis, folks. It gets you fucking hyped.
It absolutely does. When I was composing the theme music for this podcast, I was listening to this for inspiration, and it was really tough to not copy it because it's so iconic.
It's hard.
I'm like, how am I not going to sound like this, but also sound like this?
I mean, the other thing is, like, as we just said, basing it on 1, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah.
It's like, not only is it iconic and singular, but you can't avoid those notes when writing something. Yeah. So it's like, how do you not sound like you're copying it? You know what I mean?
Listen,
it's like
there's 12 semitones.
It's like he used all the meat. You know what I mean? Like, what are you supposed to do?
Right.
Yeah. It was tough but rewarding process. All right. Number two.
Hell yeah.
Ben Kenobi's theme,
fuck
aka
yeah.
The Force theme.
Ben!
Oh, I love this.
I think this is my favorite. Gorgeous. Beautiful.
Then it goes into this. Ah.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
This oh my God.
Beautiful. This is going to make me cry.
This is actually my favorite.
This is my favorite
singular
too.
Melody in all of Star Wars. They reprise it in the end title medal ceremony. It is
gorgeous.
Extremely flexible. And it's in almost every trailer. It conveys a sense of mystery, but also sadness. It's just an incredibly flexible melody that I absolutely love. And you can play it with the full orchestra, or you can play it with just, you know, a woodwind. And when you just play it with the one woodwind, it is so fucking sad.
Flexible, just like Obi-Wan, you know, ass Satine. Wrong mood. Am I misreading the room?
I love Satine was great. Love the Duchess. And a Duchess, too. Yeah. That's the other thing.
Oh, she's a keeper, folks.
Yeah.
Or she was.
So I think we're all in agreement here. This is our favorite theme.
Like, yeah.
I don't know if it's my favorite overall theme, but just that melody. It's my one favorite melody from all of Star Wars.
It's my favorite because it just evokes so fully that brew of emotion that Star Wars brings. That sense of longing and that sense of possibility, a little bit of despair, but also that promise of something greater.
I just immediately see Luke staring off
at the suns
into the distance, wondering what comes next, what next the galaxy has in store for him. It's just amazing.
So this is a little less recognizable than the main theme, but it's still one of those like, oh, I've definitely heard this before melodies. And it is used so much through the films. Like, doing research for this, I was just kind of like scrolling through all the movies. And it is used
everywhere. It's in a lot of the trailers.
Everywhere on the
everywhere.
Timeline. You just like go to any random spot in the timeline and you play for like a minute. It appears in some form or another. And it's this, we just talked about it, but it's that melancholic refrain that starts the cue on the minor tonic chord. And it like briefly lands on the major subdominant, which is like this wondrous feeling. So it's not all sad. But then part B of it, the string section in the binary sunset scene, it's like a lot more straightforward, like a lot more longing, yearning.
Yes.
And it's so beautiful. I can't stop saying that it's so beautiful because
it is. It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. It brings a tear to your eye hearing it. It really does.
And it should be noted that this theme, much like the main theme, starts on that perfect fourth interval up from the dominant to the tonic, except for that this is in a minor key. John Williams just loves a perfect cadence is all I can say. Number three.
Yeah.
Leia's theme.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Wonderful.
I think of like Venus appearing on the half shell, you know, like, or like nymphs I love that the use of the strings there and the that creates
the
this
trills.
Like kind of the trills, this kind of like bed of sound through which like
a bed of sound on which you might one day fuck your sister.
I mean, why not? And the one, what is that? Is that an oboe? What is that?
Oh,
it's some kind of woodwind. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Guys, I once played the clarinet.
Wonderful.
Did you?
In middle school music, a couple years in a row. And for multiple weeks in a row, my reeds were so broken I couldn't use them, and I just pretended to play during class.
Man,
it's a true story.
Just a great everything, man. John Williams, what a fucking king!
Yeah, this was the one theme doing research for this that I was like, I didn't know how beautiful this was until I paid attention.
Yeah,
and I was like, it's so simple, it's so easy, but it's so delicate, and like there's a depth to it. It features like this tender melody that's enveloped in a dreamy chord progression. It's
dreamy
two chords.
Dreamy is a great word for
it. I think that, you know, Mal, you joke about wanting to fuck your sister, but I think that's I actually think that Williams is doing something fascinating here, which is, listen, Leia, it doesn't take long in A New Hope for Leia to establish herself as a pretty badass, like, fighter ready to heft a blaster and kill stormtroopers. This theme in particular is, who are we experiencing seeing Leia as with this theme? It's like through Luke's eye. You're seeing her through Luke's eyes with this theme song.
The sound is appealing.
Yes.
And it's intriguing. And you don't totally understand why. There's a purity, but also, ultimately, more crucially, a kind of sneaky complexity.
Yeah. Yes. So that complexity, it's actually going from the tonic chord, which is very straightforward, to the supertonic diminished 7/1, which is like a... To explain it in Nashville terms, it's basically the 4 minor with a 2 added to it. And it borrows from the parallel minor scale. And it creates that lifted feeling. The 5 sharp lifts the general sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
An extremely effective use of this is during The Last Jedi. Mm-hmm. When now General Leia Organa of the Resistance is floating out in space after the Resistance ship is hit. And the motif is like gently played over this string soundscape. And then like weaves in and out of the Force theme as she opens her eyes and taps into the Force to return to the ship. And it's just like, oh my God. Like, what? Number one, how beautiful the sound is, but also it's moving to see this person that we've seen grow up, basically, from princess to this valiant fighter, this warrior, to this general, now this established legendary figure. It's so compelling.
Beautiful.
Number four, the iconic... dare I say, maybe more iconic than the main title, Imperial March.
It's hard to...
I think you might be right.
It's honestly hard to... Yeah. Great use of the rhythm section here.
Oh, yeah.
Timpanis and the snare to really give you the sense of an army on the march. They're coming towards you. You can't stop them. It's implacable.
Yeah. The crazy thing about this is when I looked this up, the Imperial March doesn't actually appear in
Empire.
A New Hope.
Empire.
It only comes in from Empire.
Shocking shit.
I had thought for sure this was in A New Hope, but no.
Imperial Attack is somewhat similar. Hmm. But yeah, Imperial March doesn't come into Empire. Absolutely iconic. And the use of the brass, again, that brass gives you the feeling of strength, of power, you know, of an army band.
It's so bold.
Marching behind its troops.
It's ruthless.
Troops. Yeah.
Yeah, it's unrelenting. It like drills despair into your
muscular.
Bones.
Muscular.
Yeah. And by the way, this iconic theme is not called the Imperial March for nothing. It plays around 100 BPM, which is in line with average walking speed and accentuates the chord notes. Bum, 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 you know?
Yeah.
It's written actually in a march style.
That's interesting.
And it's used in numerous variations throughout the films and the television shows. Most notably, in my opinion, Vader's death in Return of the Jedi, when it is played tenderly by that harp. And it's a really cool variation of it because, as we said earlier, it's ruthless. It's unrelenting. It is bold. But when played tenderly, it kind of plays as like, oh, there's a soft side to it. It humanizes Vader.
Isaac, they said that Rhaegar Targaryen loved to fight, but he just wanted to play his harp, you know?
Yeah.
Actually, this the way you're describing all of this and the way the track sounds and makes you feel, it does actually make me think of, or perhaps I should say this other thing makes me think of this, but Danny and John arriving at Winterfell and the way the way that the Winterstown people respond to seeing the dragons. This simultaneous push-pull where there's something magnetic about it that draws you in. You want to peek your head around the corner and look and see, but you're also afraid, desperately afraid. And you know when you hear that what it means. And it's so of a piece with the sound of Vader's breathing, both of those instant cues for terror.
Yeah. The way that music can be transformed in a way where you think, oh, there's no flexibility with something like the Imperial March. It's all in a minor key. Nothing can be happy about this, or nothing can be positive about this. And then you hear it in a different way and you're like, oh, wait, no, there is another side to this. Like the dragons, as you were saying. Mm-hmm. Another variation of this is when teenage Anakin slaughters the Tusken Raiders in Attack of the Clones. And as Yoda is talking to Mace Windu about the pain that he feels. Mm-hmm.
Did he feel as much pain as the men, the women, and even the children too?
The men, the women, and the children. And it plays ominously in the background like this. Dun, 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 dun. Dun, dun. Oh my God. It is, when you pay
Vader
attention
being
to
born
it.
There,
that's the seed of Vader coming up from Anakin. The third instance of this is when Palpatine dubs Anakin as Darth Vader for the first time in Revenge of the Sith.
Hell yeah.
It's pretty in your face. Like, it's pretty on the nose. You're like, oh, you expect this to come.
Right.
When he says the words, Darth Vader. But it's really effective. And this is the stuff that, Jason, you were talking about earlier, about how Williams really pushes the boundary of the score being in the background and the forefront. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those moments where everyone in the theater probably watching at the time were probably like, oh, obviously he was going to do this.
But also you get a chill. Because
also
it's
you
so
get a chill.
Cool. Yeah. It just feels right.
Cool. And then the last one that I noted is when Kylo Ren monologues at Vader's helmet, his mangled helmet.
Yeah.
Grandfather.
Grandfather.
In The Force Awakens. And this is another one of those moments where it's on the nose, but still very effective. When we see Vader's helmet and you hear it, it's really effective. I really think for a theme that seems as inflexible as the Imperial March, Williams finds a way to make it flexible. All right, next.
Next!
Yoda's theme.
Oh my God.
Yoda. You know, I could meditate to this.
Yeah. You see that I'm seeing the X-Wing lifting out of the swamp.
That's right.
Luke, astonishment and also a little bit of embarrassment mingling on his face.
This is fun.
It's really fun.
This is a great one.
It's first introduced to us like the Imperial March in Empire when we first meet Yoda.
That's right.
When he was just merely a wise Jedi master in exile, this mysterious green being and not an incompetent mess who...
I think the thing that's important that this theme evokes is that beginning with a sense of mystery and then eventually something revealed.
Yes.
Like
The
strength builds. You kind of took this character for granted when you first met him. He seemed crass, banging on R2 with his cane. And then all of a sudden you come to understand, he was hiding something from
the
me.
The layers pull back in the score just in concert with Luke's awakening. Yes. Yeah.
It's actually one of the most simple themes that Williams has among the main ones. It's like mostly quarter notes and half notes and whole notes, but it's super effective.
Well, you gotta go slow because my guy is very old.
He needs 10 years to listen to it.
He needs time to get there, okay? Whole notes and half notes, please. Quarter notes very sparingly. No eighth notes. Zero. I'm moving as fast as I can. I'm 900.
Doesn't look a day over 850. Doesn't look a day over 850. But it is actually pretty complex melodically. It veers into the Lydian mode, which all that means is it contains a sharp subdominant.
A Lydian mode, for those of you, just think really mysterious sounding and kind of spacey.
It's very unsettled. It's very like floating in the air. Number six.
Number six.
Young Anakin.
Are you an angel? I really like this one.
Yeah.
Such innocence once upon a time.
Innocent but unsettled.
Mm-hmm. Unsettled.
There's something, there's a chromaticism there.
Mm-hmm.
A restlessness?
Yeah, that speaks to, just as you said, I think a restlessness is a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So only little bits and pieces of this are actually used throughout the prequel movies, but it is presented in its entirety during the end credits for The Phantom Menace. And as you guys said, it is pretty restless. that opening phrase, for example, instead of resolving right on the tonic, it stays on that leading tone. Da, da, na, na, na. It definitely parallels the uncertainty of Anakin Skywalker and as a young child. It's also pretty jumpy. There's like a lot of third leaps and fourth leaps and seven leaps and stuff. It's also worth discussing how it weaves in the Imperial March, adult Anakin, aka Darth Vader's theme. As John Williams told NPR in 2005, quote, I wanted to create a theme for the boy Anakin and within it, try, just for fun, to try to suggest Darth Vader's Imperial March and begin to put the pieces together or take apart the pieces of the Imperial March that had already existed for 15 years and recompose it into something youthful and hopeful and potential in a positive way.
It's interesting because that so closely mirrors George Lucas's description of how he was trying to present Anakin as a character, as a young boy, you know, wanting to give you this hopeful disposition and spirit, this sense of possibility. I want to go explore the galaxy. I'm going to see it all. This kindness, this gentle heart, you know, he wants to help other people, but always underneath that.
Yeah, lurking
that,
within.
There's the seed of what's to come.
The shadow of Vader's silhouette as seen in the poster, which is better than the movie. Number seven. Kylo Ren.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Hell yeah. Teenage angst right here.
Man.
Again, the brass, the strength, the muscularity.
So it's pretty similar actually to the Imperial March in its arrangement without the actual march style, but it has all the little elements of it. The motif starts on an eighth rest and it starts at the minor dominant and then modulates down a half step into a tritone interval down to the tonic. And the tritone, of course, for those of you who are not familiar, is known as the most dissonant interval in the diatonic scale, which makes it quite unsettling to hear.
It's called the devil's
the
interval.
The devil's interval, yeah.
Oh, wonderful.
It's very much in lockstep with how we feel about Kylo at his most ruthless moments.
There was a time in compositional music history where the church actually forbid this interval to be used for religious reasons.
Holy shit.
Yeah. A little more insight into John Williams' genius. This motif appears in the abduction sequence during The Force Awakens. And as many people on the internet pointed out, the score actually transitions from this theme into a variation of Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet during the moment Kylo carries an unconscious Rey onto the ship.
Oh boy!
Jay Will is a Reylo shipper, folks.
Oh boy.
Fuck yeah, I love it.
All right, speaking of Rey, number eight, Rey's theme.
Bring it home. Oh yeah. Yeah, there we go.
It's so epic.
Yeah.
It's really a perfect theme that accompanies the sequel trilogy's protagonist. And this minor bass cue is largely marked by its return to the major subdominant, a progression we're familiar actually from the Force theme. And it's a melody that many people have pointed out bears resemblance to my favorite composer of all time, Antonin Dvorak's famous New World Symphony, a sincere and hopeful yet complex movement. It also holds a very special place in John Williams's heart. As he said in a 2016 Variety interview, he signed on for The Last Jedi after composing The Force Awakens because, quote, I told Kathy Kennedy, I'm happy to do it, but the real reason is I didn't want anybody else writing music for Daisy Ridley.
That's amazing.
He just loves Rey. He loves Daisy Ridley. And this theme, you can almost hear the care that he has for it.
That's really, really cool. Yeah, there's this kind of a tenderness to it, but also this epic budding, building force there. Somebody who is discovering identity and purpose and possibility. That's all mirrored there in the sound. That's amazing. Jason?
Yes.
Do or do not. There is no try. As we know, because every episode, we're going to honor character or idea, rally the troops, advance the cause. And today, the winner of our Medal of Bravery, we're going to do it a little differently today, is going to be the Star Wars scene for each of us that the music elevates the most. No shortage of options, obviously. I think we each actually had a couple picks. We really couldn't narrow this down to one. There are a few winners today. For me, I have two co-winners that I would like to present. The first one, the scene is the Obi-Wan, Qui-Gon, and Darth Maul duel at the end of Phantom Menace. The Q, Duel of the Fates. The reason is that I absolutely, genuinely cannot separate this sequence in the film from the sounds that play under it. Both the score with the soaring operatic Duel of the Fates. We heard the John Williams quote earlier about that religiosity, that ritualistic essence that he was trying to imbue into this sequence. But also the sound effects to the concert of these two things that we've talked about today, the lightsaber buzzing, the laser gate whooshing. You hear the movement. You feel the air shifting as these characters are navigating each other. And it's also miraculous because there's this built-in contrast of the hush when the laser gate activates and the lightsabers retract and Qui-Gon is meditating right before his death and Maul is pacing restlessly and Obi-Wan is so anxiously observing at a remove. And we just have these kind of electronic whispers as the sound has really receded. And then, boom, the tension pulses back in. The sound rises again and then the score quiets and the chants are there as the lightsaber sounds are taking center stage. And then the score just rushes back in alongside Obi-Wan's screams. Wonderful. And it's just perfect harmony. What's your first one? And then I'll give my second one.
Okay, this is my primary one. This was very difficult, but I think it has to be, for me, the Imperial March Vader's theme. The first time we hear it, we're on Hoth first, and Han has just tracked down the Imperial scout droid and put it together, and they know now that the Empire knows where they are, and right. We smash cut to space. And an Imperial Star Destroyer, and we hear that bum, bum, ba-da-dum, bum, 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 and we know that, the Empire is coming. Yep. There is no stopping them. And then the camera finds Darth Vader from behind, and we zoom in on him as he's staring out through the windows of space, watching his fleet gather and prepare to smash the Rebel Alliance. And it's just an incredibly powerful moment. Also, this is the first time that we see Vader in Empire with the new shiny armor look. Before, in A New Hope, it was a little dingier, a little more lived in. And in Empire, it's just liquid wet.
Mm-hmm.
And he just looks so impressive. The theme is based in part on a movement from Chopin's Piano Sonata No. 2 in B flat minor, as well as Gustav Holst's Mars, Bringer of War. And it is just incredible for all the reasons that we have stated. Just an iconic moment, an iconic theme that you actually are surprised to realize that this is the first time you heard it. It wasn't there right from the beginning. Incredible moment, incredible scene.
You know what I love about that and about hearing you describe it? So often with Star Wars, we talk about hope. We think about hope. That's when you realize what hope sounds like for the enemy.
Yeah, it's just like this implacable force that is coming for you, and there is no avoiding it. There's no running from it. There's no stopping it.
Incredible. So my second pick, which I think actually is my primary pick.
Sure.
This is the one that it's just fully embedded in my heart.
Sure.
Binary Sunset.
That's amazing.
From A New Hope with the Force theme playing. And we've talked about this a couple times today already, but the way that the suns, as they set on the Tatooine horizon, and the way that the Force theme as it plays, calling us as the suns call Luke, pulling him toward the great beyond, you know, that sequence, that moment, that pairing of really astonishing visuals and sounds might cut to the heart of this story and what it is more fully than any other snapshot. I think you could make that case. And I think I feel that way. There's just such longing and desperation and sadness, but also such promise, such possibility. There's balance in it as perfection.
You've described it so perfectly. I love that moment. I love this theme. Beyond the bombast and the strength of some of the other themes that are so iconic, to me, this is the entry point where Star Wars transcends the genre tropes in which it is based and becomes something magical and something else. It's that experience that everyone has had at different moments of their life where you're standing on the precipice of something and you don't even know what it is.
You just know you want to find out.
There's just a change coming and you can feel it and you are unaware of it and you almost don't want to go, but you know you have to find out what comes next.
Yes.
But you're just thinking to yourself, where is my life going to take me? And that's what this theme and that scene evokes. And it's just incredible. It's just spine chilling. My second one, I'm going to change it up because I had the same one. This is, I think, my favorite musical cue from the ongoing trilogy is March of the Resistance.
Mm.
Here's the moment. The First Order has ambushed our friends at Maz Kanata's mansion / club / pyramid on the lake, right? Han and Chewie and Finn are being taken captive by the First Order. And then all of a sudden, there is a flurry of activity. The stormtroopers are like, uh-oh, something's coming. What is it? We don't know. All you see is like mist across the lake. And then there's that boom, boom, ba-na-dum, boom, ba-na-dum, da-na-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na, da-na-na-na-na-na. And it's the mirror image of the Imperial March. Now the good guys get their own march and they're coming. You can't stop them either. And yes, it's a little less ominous. It's a little less powerful. Also in a minor key, which I think is really cool. But it's also that, listen, we're coming in against the odds. We're outnumbered, but we're still going straight at the enemy, straight at the foe. And it gets me fucking hyped. I absolutely love this theme.
The Force is awakening.
Truly. Yes, it is.
It's amazing. Oh, this was really fun. All right, friends. Someone has to save our skins. And thankfully, we have Isaac Lee and Zach Cram, our indispensable producer and researcher, who were so immensely helpful with this episode that we really cannot thank them enough, truly. We hope that you had as much fun as we did today, that you're as excited as we are to hop back into the speeder, continue to explore the galaxy with us, and that you'll join us again next time for our discussion of Chapter 2 of The Mandalorian. Until then, remember, it's not our fault.
I hired John Williams, and then he played the Star Wars theme for me, and immediately everyone hated it.
Hated it.
Absolutely. Was like, this is garbage. I hate this. It is terrible.
Hated it.
Absolutely awful. Then he came in and he played Ben Kenobi's theme. People just walked out of the room.
They thought it was dreck.
Awful.
They
garbage.
Were offended.
I had someone throw a coffee in my face and walk out.